Thanks, Colin. Thanks to band. And powerful songs to be singing together. If you have a Bible with you, or if you're using the sheet, just grab it and open it up to Luke chapter 12 again, as we're going to work our way through this chapter. And mainly focus on the first couple of verses. Just to remind us of the context, we're really picking up a conversation that has already started, maybe even a couple of Sundays ago, okay. But particularly it's the second half of a conversation that we looked at last Sunday. You see there in chapter 12, verse 22, that the setting is Jesus spending time with his disciples. And last week, we very much heard Jesus teach his disciples about what a Christ follower's attitude should be like when it comes to possessions or stuff. And really, the whole context of all of this is as Jesus is spending and preparing not only himself to make his way to Jerusalem, where ultimately he was to give his life, he is very much teaching and training his disciples and very much explaining to them, if you want to follow me, this is what it means. And if you've been part of Bellevue, I think you'll have already got the sense that it's not always an easy call. There's elements to it that are very challenging. And yet, even last Sunday, we were reminded that Jesus doesn't ask us anything that he hasn't already done so himself. And although it can be challenging, it is very important to be very clear what it means to be a Christian, to be a Christ follower. So last week, when we looked at our attitude to possessions and stuff, Jesus explained that neither worry nor greed should be the motivation or should feed our lives, which only will lead to a desire for having, and ultimately having more and having more again. But instead, we should have a heart that values God above all else and treasures him, so that we have a life that is not determined by possessions, but actually becomes free, even willing to sell our possessions and give to the poor. Because the life of a Christ follower is more about giving than about having. Well, this week, it's going to be all about the future. That's really what the emphasis is all about, as Jesus goes on to explain what the attitude should be of a Christ follower regarding the future. So I wonder, what do we make of the future? What do we think of the future? It's kind of a big question, isn't it, for a Sunday morning? But I wondered if some of us are excited. We're just simply excited because maybe we have the prospect of starting a new job and we're excited about the new challenge. Or maybe we've just started a relationship and we're excited to see where that's going to take us. Life is good. Life couldn't be better. So we're maybe not thinking so much about the future. We're really just enjoying what it's like now. But maybe you're on the other end of the spectrum where actually it's not excitement, but it's worry. I'm not going to go into the whole Brexit or stay, but I wonder how you're feeling about it, even the confusion of what side to be on, and what is it going to ultimately mean for, I guess, our purse, our money? On top of that, of course, the increased taxes that seem to be coming Scotland's way. Or maybe just simply, apart from anything else, you're wrestling with the idea that you're getting older, and that doesn't mean just the older people amongst us. You can even get that feeling even in midlife. But some of us can be worried or maybe even scared. What about all this immigration? And how is that ever going to be solved? Or what about the terrorism that we've been seeing? Is it going to come ever closer? Do you ever use the word blasé? Is that a word we understand? Because I do also think that so there's excited people, worried people, but there's also people that are kind of a blasé about the future. We don't think much about it. I hope this is not rude, but we fly by the seat of our pants. Because basically our argument is, who knows what's going to happen, so why worry? Sometimes I'm envious of people like that. Life's got to be great for them. But actually, one thing is very clear in this section, is that followers of Jesus do know the future. Look with me to verse 40, where Jesus says, to his disciples, you also must be ready because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect it. you also be ready, because the Son of Man will come. What is Jesus talking about? What does he mean, Son of Man? What does he mean, will come? Who's he talking about? Well, I think for some of us who are familiar with the Bible, we might immediately run on to the glorious return that we've been singing about already in the future. But most likely, the disciples at that stage were maybe thinking back to words that Jesus had spoken in chapter 9, where he had explained and started talking about this Son of Man, referring to himself in the most humble of terms, explaining that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and must be killed and yet also be raised on the third day back to life. It makes sense that actually the cross is probably part of what Jesus is talking about when we see in our section in verse 50 that Jesus talks about the cross when he says, "But I have a baptism to undergo, and how distressed I am until it is completed." So I think the first thought is actually the cross. But Jesus probably has himself already those two meanings in mind. On the one hand, he certainly wants to prepare his followers for the immediate days ahead, when Jesus would give his life on the cross and would be absent from them for a little while, and yet also return through the resurrection, being brought back to life. But of course, also looking beyond the cross to the future return of Jesus at the end of time. Now, this preparation was incredibly crucial, because we know that the disciples, although they had heard these words that all this was going to happen, were actually still left totally confused, scared, and unsure when all of Jesus' predictions about his life and his death on the cross became reality. And many, if not most, had scattered. It were mainly the women that were still there, left at the cross. Where was Peter? Where was James? Where was Judas? And so I guess for us today, on the one hand, we can sing about this glorious day. But the question arises, not so much concerning the cross, but very much looking ahead to this return of Jesus. When Jesus' return is upon us, how will Jesus find us? Will he also find us confused, scared, unsure, even though he's been trying to teach us through God's word and prepare us for what is ahead? Well, Jesus goes on, understanding that his disciples aren't always the quickest in picking things up. He then tells his followers how they should be facing the future. And he tells them three things. These are the three things I want to focus on this morning. First of all, he tells them, put on an apron. Secondly, he says, sleep with one eye open. And thirdly, spend time in the crow's nest. So apron, one eye, crow's nest. First of all, the apron. I was going to bring our apron, but it's not very clean, so I thought I'd get told off by Dollar. But an apron to me has that kind of symbol, and I hope that doesn't sound too heavy, but it symbolizes working for something in the future. I mean, you got guests coming. People coming to stay. What do? You put your apron on, or maybe a penny, but I don't have a penny. You go and clean the toilets, you make the bed, you hoover the floors. Or maybe it's not people staying over, but it's a dinner party, so you get cooking. Many men are foolish enough not to put on an apron, but put on an apron, because you'll always be splashing, and get ready. Get the table ready, food ready, all in anticipation of the chat and the laughter and the sharing that will happen later on. Look at verse 35. What does Jesus say? He says, be dressed, ready for service. Put an apron on. The life of a Christian is a life with an apron on. Literally, it actually says, let your loins stay girded. That doesn't sound so sexy, does it? Let your loins stay girded. It's probably a reference back to the time of the Exodus. That the gowns that the Jews would have worn were very long, and you could have tripped over them if you wanted to. They were just not very handy to run in. So when God told them to get ready
to lead them out of Egypt, lead them out of slavery. He told them to tuck in those long gowns with the belt around so they'll be ready to go. Ready to go. Paul also seems to be talking about a similar picture in Ephesians chapter 6 as part of the armor of God, giving that idea of not just ready to go, but also ready to stand firm. But we know in verse 43 of our chapter that there's also the sense of serving. Verse 43, it says, "It will be good for that servant whom the master finds doing so when he returns." It's a picture of a house that has been left in charge of this steward to look after it, to serve it well in the way that the master would have wanted him to. So readiness is about being ready to go, ready to stand firm, but also being ready to serve. We can't just stand ready, but our readiness is supposed to be an active readiness. Do you know what it made me think of? And it's not a very good example, but it made me think of a sub, someone on the bench. I'm one of those people that used to spend time on the bench. And my heart always goes out when you see these professional football teams and there's these guys on the bench. Their job is so much harder sometimes than the guys on the field. Because they can't just sit there and get all flabby again. They got to do all the same training. They got to do all the same preparation. They got to be as fit as they can be, hoping that their manager is going to say, "It's time to go on." Now, God doesn't look at us as subs. He gives us much more responsibility than that. So that's kind of where the image breaks down. But it's that idea that we have to be ready, fit, so that whenever God calls on us, whenever he returns, we can actually say, "God, we were expecting you. We were expecting you." So as Christ followers, Jesus simply wants us to realize that, I mean, it's good to rejoice about our future. We can live consciously of heaven, but actually it must be an active consciousness. It must be an actively anticipation of a certain future that we have. And we do this through active, faithful service. Service, by the way, will actually help and also build that same anticipation. Just try to picture this, that as we serve the one that we're expecting in his absence, it will actually help us to stay focused and not forget what life is about. Life is about later. Serving is also where we see the link with the continuation of the conversation on possessions. Because stuff just gets in the way. Stuff will get in the way of our ready anticipation of that glorious day. Remember how we noticed that when it comes to stuff, we're supposed to be having a life of giving more than having. Well, that's the same of living a life with an apron on. It's about giving more than having. So there's the first thing. Put your apron on. Secondly, sleeping with one eye open. I actually had a friend who slept with two eyes open. Have you ever seen that? It's the freakiest thing ever. He also slept slightly, sitting, slightly up. And his eyes wouldn't be totally open, but they would be half open. And I remember testing to see if he was really asleep, but he was. But it was freaky sharing a room with him, although the person himself was fine. But I looked up. There are actually animals. Well, it's funny when you Google about animals and sleeping. Some can switch off half their brains. Now, I don't think that's the intention here. But there are actually animals that can sleep with one eye open. Does anybody know an animal that can do that? It's actually the crocodile. I thought it was birds, but it's the crocodile who can sleep with one eye open so they can watch for prey, which doesn't come along very often. Is that cool? So he really sleeps, but he's got one eye open. Another animal that doesn't sleep with one eye open, but I also thought would be really cool to apply it to the Christian life, is a chameleon. We were at the museum not too long ago, the National Museum in the center, where they have these two cameras which give you the indication of what a chameleon can see. You know how they have their eyeballs just sitting on the sides of their faces, and they can turn them individually from each other? They can see everything all the time. Maybe we don't want that. But basically, what Jesus is telling us in verse 35 and onwards, he says, keep your lamps burning. And keep them burning like men awaiting their master to return, ready to immediately open the door when he does. What if Jesus came back right now? What if Jesus came back right now? Maybe some of us would think, I'm lucky that he's finding me in church. That's got to count for something. But we've already seen that when it comes to following Jesus, being a Christian, it's a heart matter, isn't it? Would we be pleased if he would come? Well, he probably wouldn't come through the door, would he? But would we be pleased and thrilled and maybe even saying, finally, I've been looking forward to this moment. I wasn't sure what it would look like, but here you are. Or would we be embarrassed? Or maybe even find that we've been thinking, you know, I was convinced that none of this was true, and here he is, this Jesus. Would we be ready to open the door just like that picture that Jesus gives us? Or would we actually be too busy because life just right now is too much fun? Or we have to look after a baby like Peter does. Very good for Mother's Day, isn't it? Oh, he's always like this, isn't he? Yeah. Would we be ready to open the door or be too busy? Now, this burning light is probably a reference, or could be a reference, to a parable that Jesus taught, which was recorded by Matthew in chapter 25, about five wise and five foolish virgins. They were waiting for a bridegroom to come, who took a very long time in coming. But the wise had brought extra oil, and the foolish hadn't. So when the bridegroom finally comes, the wise were ready to meet him, and they go with him and with him into the wedding banquet, but the five foolish didn't. Now, this parable is very much about being prepared as well as being awake. But I don't think it's because Jesus is looking for the perfect people. But what he is aware of, what Jesus knows and understands, is the reality of darkness. And the reality that even if he is eager to have come back, maybe even already yesterday or 100 years ago, but waiting for his father to say, this is the right time to go, he knows how important it is for us to not just be ready, but to also be alert and awake. All followers of Jesus will experience the ups and downs. There will be stretches of bright light and the mountaintop experiences, but as well, there will be experiences of murky darkness where we will find it hard to keep going. Where we will be wondering, is he still to come back? Will he still come back in my life? Edinburgh itself is a dark place spiritually. It can be incredibly challenging to follow Jesus continuously and throughout our life. Hence Jesus' warning, we mustn't fall asleep, we mustn't give up, and when we can, whether it's at church or in our quiet times, we must refuel and have extra oil for those stretches when it's dark, to have it for later. Hence Jesus says, be ready, but also be awake. Keep your lamp burning. Thirdly, then, the crow's nest. Jesus says, in verse 37, it says, it will be good for those servants who finds them watching or on the lookout when Jesus comes. I wonder if these three are like a tripod. Follow with me. I think you can be awake without being alert or watchful. I think we can be watchful without being prepared. I think we can serve without being watchful. And any of these will endanger our readiness for when Jesus comes. I quite enjoy the Bourne movies, the Bourne Identity and that kind of stuff. I don't know if everybody's familiar with them, but it's about a trained, well, soldier, spy. It's hard to maybe identify, but very interestingly, it's a person who wakes up not exactly sure of who he is and what he's been made into. And through the movies, he discovers the truth. But quite early on in the storyline, he finds himself sitting in a cafe, all of a sudden realizing that actually what he's done while he's drinking his coffee is he's been watching. He's been trained to watch. He's observed and seen everything that had been going on in that cafe, including how many people were inside, what they were doing, as well as where the exits would have been for them, for him to escape to. Being watchful. Well, Jesus says that's exactly the call of a follower of Christ. We must be on the lookout. We must be alert. We must be watchful. And actually, what we see should encourage us. Because when we look around, when the world sees natural disasters or wars or new epidemics that just keep coming up, we must know and understand that actually Jesus is closer now than ever before. What does it say in Matthew chapter 24? Does Jesus not tell us that when all this will happen, Jesus says, watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name claiming that I am the Christ and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Because such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Watch out that no one deceives you. So the future is sure. It's closer than ever before. Hence the call for the follower of Jesus to be constantly ready, awake, and watching. Now, unfortunately, Jesus continues on in verse 45 to 53, explaining that reality will be different. He explains that actually, instead of people being ready, there will be unfaithfulness. There will be division. There will be hypocrisy. There will be unwillingness. There will be impatience. Even blindness. That people are able to explain all the different signs that are out there, but it doesn't seem to make them see and understand that all these signs lead to Jesus. Some will give up waiting, Jesus says. Some will think they know better. It's not going to happen. And some will become lazy and careless. And unfortunately, the consequences are clear. There is a day of reckoning. And it's very uncomfortable reading when we read in Luke 12, verse 46. Sorry, I've just lost my page. Luke 12, verse 46, where he says that the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he's not aware of it. And he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. But as we've noted before, people, this is not to scare us, but it's to warn us. There's a Christian artist, I think he's still alive, called Larry Norman, who had a big influence on Christian artists really coming after him, who had a song called I Wish We'd All Been Ready. And he explains in an interview once that he remembers singing this to a crowd, a concert hall full of people. And as he was singing it, he was looking around. And he choked up and he said, I couldn't finish the song. As he was singing about the return of Jesus, he sang, I wish we'd all be ready. And he was thinking, I wonder if he's ready. I wonder if she's ready. I wonder if they're ready. People, this section is the most glorious and the most sad part of Scripture. And Jesus has to warn us and say, get your business in order. Be reconciled before the dispute is brought before the judge, he says in verse 57 and onwards. In other words, we, you and I, must get our business sorted. We're in need of being in a right standing with God, the judge of the whole universe. I wish we'd all be ready. But let's finish on a high note. Because it's not a warning so that we avoid something bad, but actually it's a warning so that we get to enjoy something incredibly good. Again, look with me to verse 37. Because when we do hear, and we do obey, and we do get our business in order and repent and come to God to seek forgiveness, look at the great future that is ahead of us. When this Son of Man returns, it's described in verse 37 as follows. It says it will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. I tell you the truth, he will dress himself to serve, will have them recline at the table, and will come and wait on them. Do you get how shocking this is? The roles get reversed. The master becomes the servant and tells you, come and recline at the table. And Jesus has done this before. He came to serve, not to be served, when he gave his life on the cross. But the same picture is given of his glorious return. That's God. God who through Jesus will not only say, well done, good and faithful servant, but he'll also say, pull up a seat, come to the table. God, the great host. It's not the first time we find this in the Bible. Psalm 23. What do we read in Psalm 23? Here's King David, the songwriter, spoke of something similar when he says, you, O God, prepare a table before me. In the presence even of my enemies, you anoint my head with oil. Surely I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Or what about Revelation chapter 19? Right at the very end of the book, John, the author of the book, is allowed to write down what this angel says. He says, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb. We get to sit at the table of the Lord. But until then, 1 Corinthians 15 sums it up well. Until then, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain.